Right. Good morning, everyone. I'm Victoria Clark from the Investec Economics team, and welcome to our fortnightly economics Q&A session. We are very lucky to be joined by another excellent guest this week, and today we have with us Kieran Russell. Kieran is a director in our foreign exchange team. He's got a particular focus on corporate foreign exchange strategy, and he's former vice president of FX derivative sales at Barclays Capital. He's got a genuine passion for foreign exchanges and has been helping corporates mitigate their risk here for decades. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to what he has to say, particularly amidst the moves in sterling and markets that we're seeing at the moment. But before we get stuck into the meat of this session, I just need to run through a few housekeeping points for all of you. So firstly, just to let you know, you've all been automatically placed on mute. You can submit questions throughout the session. There's a Q&A feature on your right-hand side, which you can use to do that. If you type your question, say, ask all panelists, and then press submit, it should come through there. If you do have any issues as we go through the session, again, you can type those in there. A member of our team should get in contact with you to help resolve those. We are recording this session. There will be a link emailed out. And also, just very finally, there will be a survey in the webinar end pages. It would be great if you do have time to complete this at the end of the session. So without further ado, I'd like to start with an economic update. Now, the regular listeners to these sessions will know that one of the hobbies of the economics team, and me in particular, has been getting hold of real-time economic data through the pandemic and really trying to gauge how the economy has been moving forward in as close to real-time as we can. But whilst my appetite for this hasn't waned, I want to have a look today at some official data because it's been a really big morning for UK economic data since we've had the first official metrics of how the UK economy has fared through the second quarter, what the coronavirus impact has been. And, you know, without much surprise, but nevertheless, rather depressingly, the UK economy has re-entered recession. We've now had it confirmed this morning that we've had two consecutive quarters of negative UK GDP growth. And we had the biggest drop in output over the second quarter since those comparable GDP records began in 1955. That was a drop of 20.4%. It wasn't a million miles away from most forecasters' expectations, but nevertheless, it's a pretty somber headline that we look at this morning. And it's a bigger decline than we saw for other Western economies over the second quarter, you know, even worse than Spain's 18.5% drop. You know, partly that reflects the difference in timings through which people entered restrictions and how tight restrictions have been. But nevertheless, even if you take the first half of the year overall, the UK's drop in GDP is still more severe than France's, Italy's, Germany and the US. So we have been hit particularly severely. And that in particular reflects the significance of the consumer sector in the UK economy and household spending and its dominance there. So, you know, as we stand looking at these figures at the morning, at the end of the second quarter, real GDP stood back at levels last seen in 2003 with output about 22% below its pre-pandemic peak. So that was, you know, that was the headline from the quarterly numbers. The interesting, more forward-looking bit of this that we got was the full set of monthly figures for this quarter, and the new number today particularly was the June GDP number. June data is important because it tells us how we've moved on as we've moved through that period. So that Q2 drop came basically in April, in an enormous drop in GDP in April. The economy then recovered modestly in May, but then in June, these June figures that we've had this morning showed us that we had an 8.7% recovery. So as we've moved through the phase reopening, as we suspected, but it's now confirmed, the UK economy came off its lows and started to recover. You know, that recovery has been different across the different sectors, and that reflects the way that the restrictions have evolved. But nevertheless, across the set, that recovery is still coming through. you know, slowly but steadily over the period. Of the three major sectors, services actually recovered with the smallest rebound. It's the largest of the UK sectors, but that reflected the fact that the bigger reopening for services actually came after the end of the second quarter. And of course, all of this came ahead of the summer statement with the temporary VAT cut to leisure and hospitality, the Eat Out to Help Out incentive, which has been popular in August, the stamp duty holiday. All of that's come after this Q2 figure, but certainly this has set the tone. So since then, where are we? Well, we don't have the July figures yet, but we strongly suspect, looking at these real-time data that I track pretty closely, that the economy has grown even more in July. The real-time data certainly suggests that. If we look at key surveys, and the purchasing managers indices showed, suggested a strong rebound in July, and particularly for services where we had that bigger reopening of the hospitality sectors. If you look at BRC's retail sales monitor, that again points to a pretty decent recovery coming through, and footfall seems to be coming back on the high streets too. It's interesting if you look at the impact of the Eat Out to Help Out scheme, which became available from August, and that certainly boosted open table restaurant reservation numbers, which were up about 20% year on year for last Wednesday, which was the first Wednesday that you could do it, and it doesn't seem to have displaced other actions. So certainly there seems to be a boost coming through from the summer statement action that we've had from the Chancellor, and transport metrics all telling us the same thing. The recovery is continuing through July, and even with the localised lockdowns, more recovery coming through in August. But, you know, clearly there is a long way to go. And as I said, from these big figures that we've had confirmed this morning, that recovery has a big hill to climb. Now, what are our forecasts? Well, near term, our forecasts still envisage a robust Q3 GDP rise overall. We still suspect that this lopsided V recovery is the most likely, but clearly there is a risk that we get a flatter recovery, perhaps with an overwhelming second wave coming through. That's something that the Chancellor seems to be looking at a bit more now. We've heard him reports that he's thinking about pushing back the autumn budget if we do get that second wave as a way to hold back some of his fiscal power. So in terms of the numbers, well, with our forecast, we'd still see GDP down maybe 3.5%, but there's obviously a lot of uncertainty in the numbers at the moment, but still perhaps around that far down on pre-COVID numbers, even at the end of this year. And, you know, one concern for us is that there is a risk that the recovery could run out of steam a little bit as we get to the end of the year, as, you know, the squeeze from the labour market hits consumption, consumer demand and household spending. Because although we have an unemployment rate which is pretty much unchanged over pre-pandemic levels, what we've learned also from figures out this week from labour market numbers is that this doesn't represent the true picture, that lots of people have just opted out of the jobs market for now and moved into inactivity, and clearly their household financial positions will be affected by that. So, look, a lot of data still confirming our suspicion that the recovery is picking up pace and will continue to do so through Q3, but clearly some significant risks there, certainly over Q4 and beyond. And, you know, clearly we continue to watch the evolution of the virus and the impact that the government has to take, the responses the government has to take as those virus numbers evolve. Now, I want to make a few final points. Firstly, on virus watching, we're seeing lots of focus on rising UK case numbers. That's, you know, clearly still important, as are the reinfection rate numbers. But also importantly now, given the focus on localised lockdowns, is the spread of the virus. So obviously, if you've got a lot of cases in one place, the economic implications of that now with the focus on localised lockdown is probably less, because the government is going to try and lock down a particular area rather than, you know, it will do everything it can to avoid that big national lockdown once again and try to be a bit smarter about the way it manages and contains the virus. Secondly, on interest rates, we had a big interest rate meeting and policy report from the Bank of England last week. There's still quite a lot of focus on whether we could see a negative bank rate. There was a focus box in the report from the Bank of England last week, which suggests that that the bank is still resisting this. It hasn't ruled it out, but it favours using more quantitative easing, which particularly has dealt with some of the market strains which emerged, such as in the gilt market earlier this year. But that quantitative easing and things like forward guidance, it indicated last week, remain a key focus for the BOE rather than negative interest rates at this point. And I think, you know, our position has been that it would take a much more material shift in the economic backdrop as we move into next year to persuade them that negative bank rate is something that they want to do. They are concerned about the side effects, such as through implications on bank profitability and therefore bank lending from going there. And then very finally on Brexit, rather, the transition period for Brexit ends December 31st. The clock is obviously ticking, therefore, for a free trade deal. Talks are paused now for the summer, but there has been a notable shift in tone over the last couple of weeks where, say, Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove is sounding a bit more optimistic that they're getting some movement from Brussels on the red lines. We heard Chancellor Rishi Sunak talking about a deal coming through in September time. So it may be that after a lot of bad news, certainly some pretty negative headlines this morning, that perhaps on Brexit and certainly at least on the near-term economic numbers as they catch up with what's been happening, we do start to see some slightly more positive signs. Thank you very much. I will pass over to Kieran now for his thoughts on the foreign exchange front. Kieran, over to you.
Thank you, Victoria, and hello, everybody. I hope you're all well and are enjoying the summer heat rather than melting away in it like I have been in my home office this week. As Victoria mentioned, I'm going to be talking to you about the big themes that have emerged in currency markets, certainly since our last webinar, as well as give you a flavor of the type of flows we've seen from our corporate client base as they've looked to manage these currency fluctuations. Finally, we'll take a moment to look forward to see what's to come. For those of you that follow the market, you won't need me to tell you that it's been an unbelievably interesting time in currency markets over the last few weeks. The dollar has been the main protagonist without any shadow of a doubt, and I will endeavor to explain why in a bit. Let's start by looking at the sterling dollar rate, or cable as we call it, as movement this year in cable highlights just how unpredictable markets have been. Sterling dollar started the year at the lofty height of 132. It then dropped 14% to 114 in March when the UK went into full lockdown, recall, before clawing its way back up into a whippy range-bound period within the green lines. In this period, risk sentiment was decidedly mixed as investors struggled for direction between improving economic data as the economy opened up on the one hand, and rising COVID cases on the other. The final 7% gain, well, that's only happened since June, where cable peaked at 131.86 last week. More tellingly, the final 5% of that appreciation came only in the last 2 weeks of July. On the corporate FX desk, it's meant that July was one of the busiest months we have ever seen. In volume terms, the month of July equaled the highest volume month ever. In terms of hedging activity, predictably, the vast majority of this was conducted by dollar buyers. Most dollar buying hedging portfolios were underweight going into the month, leading clients to layer in new deals, typically targeting levels at or above 130. Even more conservative clients were keen to ensure hedges offered participation to levels well above 130, meaning the split of flexible to fixed hedging was heavily skewed towards flexibility, as the average number of clients that hedged with FX options-based strategies more than doubled in July versus previous months in 2020. We were also seeing clients happy to hedge further out than previously, with the volume-weighted tenor of hedges in our corporate book moving 89 days further out on average than the tenor we'd seen in the previous 6 months. Whilst hedging activity was certainly high, people were still left scratching their heads as to why the dollar weakened in July against a backdrop of rising US COVID cases. The anticipated flight to safety investment flows into the safe haven dollar, which happened back in March, didn't happen this time. Instead, the dollar weakened not only against the pound, but across the board, with the DXY or dollar index dropping 5% in the month of July. The DXY, remember, measures dollar strength against a basket of currencies. So the question is, why did we not see the dollar strengthen on rising COVID uncertainty? And closer to home, why did we not see sterling dollar move lower when there was little progress on the Brexit front? Well, there were a number of contributing factors. First and foremost, there was also a massive euro rally. It all really happened on the 21st of July. That was the date when the leaders of the 27 European Union struck a unanimous deal on a huge coronavirus recovery package, offering $750 billion in grants and loans. This sparked a raft of investor flows out of the dollar and into the euro, with euro-dollar reaching 119 last week, a level not seen since 2018. Around the same time, we saw risk on dollar selling as news broke of encouraging data from early stage human trials of a vaccine developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca, where it was reported that a jab could be ready by early next year. Further to this, negative real rates in the States pushed investors to look at other asset classes too. For instance, risk-averse investors moved into safe havens such as gold, whilst coincidentally trading at all-time highs last week. And those with a higher risk appetite moved into equities where dividend yields are still achievable. Finally, there were monetary policy and fiscal policy reasons too. On the former, the Federal Reserve had suggested they will keep policy accommodative for some time in order to help the U.S. economy pick itself up. And on the latter, the failure of Congress to get the U.S. virus relief package over the line before it broke for recess at the end of last week put the dollar under further pressure. As for the sterling side, the pound certainly benefited from the fact that the economy started to open up further, with month-on-month data improving as a result. Whilst there were and continue to be localized lockdowns and we do need to keep an eye on the rising cases, for the time being, the market is watchful rather than being overly concerned by this. With regards to Brexit news, a lack of movement in July did little to hinder the pound's progress. Suppose no news is good news, and as Victoria mentioned, we have seen some positive sound bites from Michael Gove and the like. So it is very much watch this space. But on monetary policy too, Bank of England member or Bank of England members, including the Governor Bailey, have more than once mentioned that negative rates are not appropriate for now, and this has taken the edge of concerns that this could be a viable policy tool, certainly in the second half of the year. So the question is, where do we go from here? What is on the horizon and what are the bank forecasts telling us? Well, at the start of July, the median view of 83 financial institutions polled by Bloomberg had sterling dollar at 125 by the end of this quarter, 126 by the end of quarter four, 128 by the end of quarter one, and by mid-year next year, they had it at 129. These now stand a touch higher across those dates, with the median view now at 127, 128, 129, and 130. So yes, the current sterling dollar spot rate is already above the current median market forecast going out to June 21, implying that the amount of dollar weakness that we have seen in the last few weeks has definitely caught the market out by surprise. Outside of the macro data and the big COVID news rather, which seems to be a slugfest now between second wave threats and positive vaccine news, there are, however, plenty of other things to watch out for. We often talk about the US-China trade war, but is there a UK-China war of sorts brewing? The UK said that it will provide a path to citizenship for potentially millions of Hong Kong residents as a result of the new security laws which China has unveiled. Plus, there has also been a complete U-turn by the government on using Huawei as a 5G network provider. Also, keep an eye on the unemployment data. With the furlough scheme ending in October, reports suggest a third of UK employers might have to lay off workers once the scheme ends, which clearly will not be good news for the wider economy or the pound. And finally, of course, there is that little hurdle called Brexit that still needs to be climbed over. Whilst the UK has been sending out those positive sign bites recently, we all know how quickly things can turn around there. Stateside, I've already mentioned the US-China trade war. Tensions continue to escalate as Trump this week imposed sanctions on 11 Chinese and Hong Kong officials. Speaking of Trump, he also has a small matter of a U.S. election to navigate. Whilst President Trump correctly pointed out that the U.S. has less coronavirus cases than the world in a recent interview with Axios, his COVID policy undoubtedly has played a part in the slide in his poll ratings. As such, it came as no surprise that Trump decided to change his COVID strategy. After all, the U.S. has less than 4% of the global population, but accounts for more than a fifth of the world's COVID deaths. In July, he started to wear a face mask in public for the first time, and he also suggested that perhaps it wasn't a bad idea for others to wear one too. He also reinstated the coronavirus briefings, and now that numbers have begun to stabilize in the U.S., are we all in for a surprise at the upcoming November election? Perhaps like a professional athlete coming round the bend in the 400 meters, he's timing his sprint perfectly and is about to put Joe Biden to the line in that race to the White House. On that thought, I'll leave it there and hand back to Victoria to see if we've had any questions.
That's excellent. Thanks, Kieran. So I hope you can all hear me. What we'll have now is a few minutes, five up to 10 minutes really for Q&A. Just a reminder, if you do have any questions, please do log those in the Q&A section on the right-hand side of your screen. I can see we've got a couple already, but please do continue to pop them in there if there is anything you'd like to ask. The first question I can see is actually back for you, Kieran. It's a question where somebody's saying that my company imports from Europe. And whilst the pound has strengthened against the dollar recently, we have not seen a similar move against the euro. So can you explain why this is and what the forecasts are going forward?
Thank you for the question. You're correct. Sterling euro hasn't rallied at all. And there are a lot of offsetting factors. I think the euro fiscal stimulus package has given, obviously, the euro a lot of a boost, and obviously that's set against the opening of our economy in July, where numbers have been better. So that's one reason. I think for the mathematicians out there, it can be simply put down to the fact that sterling euro is across at the end of the day. The bigger brothers, that sterling dollar and euro dollar, have both moved up, as you've seen in those charts, due to the dollar weakness. So as they both move up, it really doesn't leave sterling euro anywhere to go, because sterling euro at the end of the day is sterling dollar divided by euro dollar. So that's just another kind of technical way of looking at it. But also, I think when it comes down to just where we are in terms of forecasts, if I cast my mind back a month, sterling euro, the forecast by Bloomberg, and that's about 80 banks polled, would have had sterling euro slightly higher than where it is now. I think the next two quarters were at 111, and then it trended up to 114 by mid-year next year. That has now shifted slightly lower, again, still very much range-bound, but it's now at 110, and that's the median forecast, at 110 for the next two quarters, going up to 112. So that shift lower does highlight two things. I think one, that you know the market really took that stimulus package from the Euro European Union well, and also they further through the process. So I think you know the COVID news that we're getting is a little bit kind of, okay, we don't know what's happening, whereas in Europe they are further through the cycle. We do need to be a little bit watchful, though, because obviously if second wave cases in Spain and the like continue to tick up higher, there will be opportunities for euro buyers, no doubt, as we watch that unfold. I hope that answers the question.
Excellent. Thanks, Kieran. Right. I can see another one up here. It says, hi, Victoria. What's your view on the current unemployment figure? Officially at 3 to 4%, but I'm not sure this factors in reduced shifts, furloughed employees. You know, is there a worry of a jump in future months? I mean, absolutely. And yes, you're spot on. So the issue with the current unemployment numbers is that the way that they're surveyed is, number one, if you're on furlough, you're not assumed to be unemployed. The Office for National Statistics won't include anyone, you know, the 9 million plus on furlough in those numbers. Second of all, as you say, people not actively searching. So, you know, as schools have been closed, for example, that's something that the Bank of England flagged last week. That has had an impact on people's search appetite and ability. And that has certainly led to quite a marked jump in inactivity, which has meant that we haven't seen the unemployment rate, the official number, budge from its 3.9% level. But, you know, if you look at the wider metrics of the labour market, there were loads out on Tuesday. Employment is down very sharply. Hiring intentions are weak. Hours worked are still very, very subdued. So as an indicator of demand for workers, they're still very subdued. So as you say in the second part of your question, is there a worry of a jump in future months? Well, yes, I think certainly as the furlough scheme closes at the end of October, that's one key crunch point where you may see some of those workers from furlough coming into those unemployment numbers rather than returning to work. And I think the Bank of England assumes that about 15% of them on furlough might do so. So that's pretty significant. The other thing is that you still, even at that point, probably aren't going to pick everything up in the official unemployment measures, because you may still find that people are still sticking around in inactivity numbers because, you know, if the jobs market's weak, maybe they hold off on the job search for a while longer. So, you know, be wary of the unemployment numbers in short, because they're not going to give us anything like the full picture of the health of the jobs market. And as I said, the kind of implications for the wider consumer sector as well. We've got questions coming in thick and fast now, actually. We've got a few minutes left, so let's take another one. So, Kieran, this looks as if it's directed at you. Do you think the current state of cable against forecasts will unwind this time? And if so, when? Have you got any views on the particular timing for that?
So, yeah, I mean, the fact that we've seen cable forecasts, spot move higher than where the forecasts in cable are currently, it does highlight a couple of things. I think for the first part, the market's been obviously caught unawares or caught off sides. And this dollar weakness, just wasn't anticipated a month or so ago. You might very well find that as we move through the cycle, we'll actually see the forecast catch up and get towards a spot. On the flip side, you might actually begin to see potentially movement the other way. And that will really come down to a lot of things that I've mentioned in the speech. So watch out indeed for, I think, the most important thing has to be the US-China trade war, the US election, and I think sterling news as well. We've kind of taken a bit of a back seat, certainly in the first half of the year. The market's purely been focused on that dollar. But as we move through the second half of the year, and as Brexit becomes more important potentially, as second wave and how that pans out, there's so many unknowns, becomes more important. We'll need to keep tabs on that. So, yeah, I mean, if you were looking at it, and again, I would always say take forecasts with a pinch of salt. But yeah, it would suggest that maybe the market is a little bit overbought at the minute.
Thank you. Okay, we've got 1 minute left, so let's take one final question. Kieran, we'll have to try and be really tight. This is a question about Biden, and if he wins the presidency, would it be good or bad for the dollar and the US economy? Perhaps I'll say something very briefly on the economy, and Kieran, I don't know if you want to comment on the dollar. So firstly, just on the economic implications of Biden, there's two things that we're looking at in brief. One is that Biden has set out a less economic friendly sort of tax stance at the moment, but Trump said virtually nothing. Now, both of them are clearly going to be in stimulative mode as we go through the next few months and probably in 2021. But at some point, they'll have a hell of a fiscal consolidation task to do. And we suspect that Biden is going to do that in a sort of less market-friendly approach and one that perhaps is less supportive for the economy. Having said that, they'll both have slightly different approaches to China as well. Kieran's mentioned this quite a bit, but Biden in particular looks to take a more collaborative approach, still trying to, take a more America-focused approach, but less aggressive, less trade-focused. He's less hooked up on tariffs than Trump is. And certainly in terms of the global risk environment, I would imagine that Biden is more friendly, more cooperative on that front. The two will both hit to different timescales. So it may be that we face the kind of tax effects first, and then as they move on to trade, that comes later. Kieran, I don't know if you want to add anything on a dollar perspective there.
Oh, I'll go along with you. I think, you know, it's really a matter of timing. Clearly, if Biden wins, it will be negative for stocks. On the flip side, it will be very positive in terms of global relations. So the U.S.-China trade war would dissipate. So whether, you know, that comes first or whether the stock market the kind of pro-business Trump mentality, you know, hits in, I'm not quite sure. We'll just have to wait and see how that pans out. But certainly, you'd expect there to kind of be movement around both of those areas.
Perfect. Well, I'm afraid, everybody, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today and for listening to everything that we've had to say. If you do have any burning questions that we haven't got to today, please do get in touch. Thanks for joining. A reminder that we have another fortnightly session coming up. So, you know, do join for that. Also, we'll continue these updates. And, you know, in the meantime, have a great day. And please also do the seminar feedback at the end of the session. But yes, thanks again for joining. That's all from us.